I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. We begin with an update on the Las Vegas mass shooting. It's a tragedy for sure, but is it terrorism? Lawmakers have revived the gun control debate. Washington Post reporter Mike DeBonis joins me to talk about the prospects for progress on gun regulation. And Dr. Sherry Parks joins me for Midday Culture Connections. More than a year ago, Colin Kaepernick took a knee during the national anthem to protest police violence against African Americans. Many believe that protest cost him a job in the NFL. When President Trump suggested firing NFL players who protest, nearly 200 players took a knee. This past Sunday, only 52 did. We'll talk about free speech in the age of Trump and where almost 20% of college students think responding to offensive speech with violence is okay. Midday starts right after these headlines. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. It's Midday, and today it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. She's an associate professor in the Department of American Studies at the University of Maryland College Park. Good to see you, Sherry.
Hi there.
And first, we're going to start with an update on the mass shooting in Las Vegas that has left at least 59 people dead and more than 500 injured almost immediately after that horrific event. Democrats and Republicans began the predictable debate about gun regulation. Unfortunately, it's a story we know all too well. Following what is now the second largest mass shooting in recent history, last year at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Democrats proposed extended background checks in private gun sales and banning sales to suspected terrorists. Two Republican proposals would have increased funding for a national background check database and would have implemented a judicial review process for people on a terror watch list when they attempted to purchase firearms. None of those bills passed. Back in 2012, after 20 children and six of their teachers were fatally shot at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, President Obama made an emotional appeal to Congress for tougher gun regulation. Obama signed several executive orders related to gun control, but neither of the two major pieces of bipartisan gun legislation proposed at that time passed in the Senate. So Congress is currently considering at least two bills that would loosen restrictions on guns. So we're going to start today with Mike DeBonis, who covers Congress and national politics for The Washington Post. He joins us on the line from the newsroom of The Post in Washington. Hi, Mike. Thanks for your time.
Hi, pleasure to be with you.
So one of the bills that Congress is thinking about is called the Sportsman's Heritage and Recreational Enhancement Act, or SHARE. And this is a bill having to do with silencers on guns. Tell us what that one proposes to do.
Sure, yes. This is a bill that does a number of things, but the provision that's attracted the most attention would deregulate, or at least partially deregulate, gun silencers. Right now, those are, if you want to buy a gun silencer, it's a rather complicated process and involves applying to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives for a special license. You have to pay $200 fee and go through a lengthy process. Under this bill, it would be more like just purchasing a rifle or a handgun, where you can go to a gun store, undergo a federal background check, and buy a silencer. There are other parts of the bill that have to do with regulation of ammunition and transporting guns across state lines, but the silencer piece has been rather controversial, and this bill came up in the House Natural Resources Committee last month, and it emerged on a party line vote, and it's been expected to come to the House floor. It hasn't yet, and Speaker Ryan said just this morning that there are no plans to bring it anytime soon. So it seems pretty clear that what happened in Las Vegas has sort of at least put this on the back burner for now. No one's ruling out that this could come up sometime in the future in this Congress, but for now it seems to be on ice.
One of the arguments that proponents of this bill make is that this would protect the hearing of hunters who are firing their weapons. What kind of traction has that argument been getting on Capitol Hill?
Obviously among the advocates of the bill and their Republican colleagues, it's been a it's been a strong argument as far as they're concerned. You know, they've pointed to other countries in Europe where silencers are not treated differently from firearms at large, where and they're seen as sort of a, you know, a safety device or a, you know, just a sort of a friendly thing to have to keep your you know, your gun from disturbing the peace. I haven't done the reporting to tell you whether that's true or not, but I can tell you that, you know, it's certainly the most common argument that's being put forth on behalf of this legislation. And in fact, in a prior version, this was referred to as the Hearing Protection Act before it was added to this larger bill. So that's how it's being couched by the advocates of this measure.
And you quote in your article in the Post yesterday, Mark Kelly, who is married to Gabby Giffords, the congresswoman from Arizona, who was severely injured in a shooting several years ago, about and he brought up the what happened in Las Vegas, saying, imagine how much worse the shooting would have been had the gunman had a silencer. So there are a lot of opponents to this bill, including a lot of people in law enforcement, saying that it would be a huge hindrance to an active shooter situation like the one that they encountered the other night.
We've heard people making that point, you know, ranging all the way to Hillary Clinton, who tweeted something along those lines yesterday. The advocates of the silencer legislation say that, you know, that's simply not true, that a high-powered rifle with a silencer, or using the terminology they prefer, a suppressor, does not make the gun silent in any way. It muffles the sound. You know, I've gone on YouTube and watched some videos of these things, and, you know, it's clearly there's a noise. The question is it as obvious that this, you know, that this is a rifle firing? I think that, you know, some of the people who I've talked to who have actually been in the presence of these things say it's an unusual, it takes it from a very obvious and, you know, report of a firearm to a more sort of something that's a little harder to identify. And I think that's the thing that Mark Kelly and Hillary Clinton and a number of other people have said being their concern about the widespread use of silencers.
And Mike, we're joined by Dr. Sherry Parks from University of Maryland.
And that is the sound that the population knows. And witnesses in Las Vegas said it was the sound that alerted them that something was going on. There's a deeper question here that often the proponents of gun, what they would call freedom, will blur the rights of hunters with other people who own guns. And many of the guns in the country are automatic weapons, which are not, they're meant to hunt people, not to hunt animals. Can you talk about that blurring as it happens on the floor? Are you seeing more of that blurring?
Of Congress, you're talking about.
Right.
Floor of Congress, uh-huh.
Right. I mean, you know, there are some people who are focused on hunting. You know, but I think that there's, by and large, you know, most Republicans, especially from more rural states where gun ownership is more common, see it as a constitutional matter and a matter of personal freedom, and they're not at all afraid to talk about it in those terms. The idea that this is about hunting is seems to be less of a case. You know, you mentioned automatic weapons. Well, actual automatic weapons, machine gun type weapons, are tightly regulated. They're very difficult to obtain. You know, the sort of guns that we've tended to see in these sorts of mass shootings are actually semi-automatic, which are, you know, basically one pull of the trigger, one shot fired. What people are asking a lot of questions about yesterday and today are, they saw a video of what happened in Las Vegas, and it very much appeared to be a rapid-fire machine gun-type weapon that, for the most part, you know, aren't seen commonly, even in these mass shootings. And people are wondering, what exactly did this guy have, and how did he get it? And even some Republicans are wondering that.
They seem to be saying this morning that he might have altered them. But it's interesting, this
right.
Use of hunting, even in the name of this bill, as the face of guns and gun ownership in this country when hunting is not protected by the Constitution. The Second Amendment doesn't mention hunting. It mentions raising a militia.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's about a militia, of course. You know, after Orlando, the Pulse shooting in 2016, House Democrats staged a 26-hour sit-in. There's a poll from Quinnipiac just in July that says a majority of Americans in every age group do support stricter gun laws. There's even a poll that says about 68% of Republicans support things like background checks. Your colleague Amber Phillips in the Post yesterday wrote about gun control advocates at the state level. This year alone have defeated nearly two dozen bills in state legislatures that would allow guns in public and, you know, guns in schools and stuff. I mean, do you sense on the Hill a groundswell of support for legislation, particularly, again, in the aftermath of one of these horrific shootings like we had in Vegas?
I mean, the sad truth is what I'm sensing is the same thing I've sensed after all of the previous tragedies since I've been covering up here, which is, you know, Democrats certainly want to talk about doing things, taking action, in particular expanding background checks and talking about high-capacity magazines and you know, restricting the ability for domestic abusers and the mentally ill to get access to weapons. Republicans, by and large, say either this is not the time to talk about this, we need to be focused on the victims, or they want to talk about mental health and things that don't involve new restrictions on guns. And I've seen very, very little to change that dynamic in the last 48 hours. I mean, or even less than that, really. You know, that's where we are. That's the message we got from Speaker Ryan this morning. That's the message we got from my conversations with Republicans yesterday and today. Democrats are going to keep trying to raise the issue. They're going to have a rally tomorrow. Former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords is expected back on the Hill, you know, who was, of course, shot and very badly wounded back in 2011. You know, this sort of cycle goes on, and it mystifies certainly the proponents of gun control how to change this. And we haven't seen any facts emerge yet to sort of scramble the normal order, and that's sort of where we are at this point. And perhaps there will be some facts that will, you know, change the way this plays out.
We have a couple of calls that we're not going to have time to take. I apologize for that. But one of the callers makes the point that silencers aren't really even silent. They actually make the gun sound like a jackhammer or a firecracker. And another points out that they also compress the muzzle flash. And in Las Vegas, people also saw the flash and as well as hearing the sound, which indicated gunfire as opposed to firecrackers. You know, when it comes to background checks, that's something that an awful lot of people do agree on, more strenuous background checks, particularly in private sales, gun shows, and that kind of thing. Is there any reason to believe that increased background check laws, legislation, would have stopped the shooter in Las Vegas? And I'm reluctant to name him. We all probably know his name. But here's a guy who had no history of mental illness, no criminal record, no particular reason to be in, you know, in the sights of law enforcement. So a background check on this man, yet another white man who commits an act of domestic terrorism, would it have even, prevented him from getting this incredible arsenal that he seemed to check into the Mandalay Bay Hotel with?
So law enforcement has not shared any information to date that would indicate that he did not pass a background check or go through the usual legal process for purchasing and acquiring these weapons. That may change, but we don't have that information at this point. The sponsor of the silencer bill that we were discussing, you know, made the point to me yesterday in a conversation that, listen, this guy had the money and the ability to go through the process and purchase dozens of weapons. You know, I guess he was found with 18 or 19 guns in the hotel room and more at his residence. And there was nothing, if he was able to do that, there was nothing stopping him from going through the process with the ATF and you know, getting a silencer. So, you know, anytime you look at the particular circumstances of an incident like this, you know, often you will find that, you know, the changes to law, to these gun laws that are being advocated, wouldn't have had an impact on the particular incident that had just happened. And that has been a frequent sort of tactic for opponents of gun control, is to point out and say, listen, you're proposing something that wouldn't have made a difference. And the, you know, the reply is, well, we need to do something, or, you know, this can save lives, even if it wouldn't have saved these lives. And we're going through that same conversation right now. And we are awaiting more details on who this man was, what steps he took to purchase these weapons, and whether all of the rules were followed. And then, you know, we'll see if there's anything that sort of scrambles this argument and moves us away from the same conversation we seem to have.
Mike DeBonis covers Congress and national politics for The Washington Post. Mike, thanks so much for your reporting and for your time today. Very much appreciated.
Sure, my pleasure.
We'll be back after a quick break with Dr. Sherry Parks for Midday Culture Connections. By the way, Dr. Parks is going to be part of a panel talking about guns at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, Thursday afternoon at 4 o'clock. It's in conjunction with an art installation called Gun Show by the artist David Hess. I spoke with David and the curator of that show, Kathy Odell, last Friday here on Midday. You can catch that conversation on our website, and you can get details about the panel that Sherry's going to be on Thursday afternoon. We've got that at WIPR.org. /midday. When we return, more of Midday Culture Connections. We're going to talk about Colin Kaepernick. We're going to talk about free speech, the First Amendment. We're going to talk about what we call an incident like what happened in Las Vegas. Our number here, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Midday here on your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. By the way, coming up on our program tomorrow, it's Midday on Ethics with Dr. Jeffrey Kahn of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. We're going to talk about gene editing. The FDA recently approved gene editing therapies for the very first time. So, what is gene editing and what are its ethical implications? That's coming up tomorrow here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us today, it's Midday Culture Connections with our good friend, Dr. Sherry Park. She's an associate professor in the Department of American Studies at the University of Maryland in College Park. And she's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. We're going to switch gears now. I want to talk about the First Amendment. I want to talk about Colin Kaepernick. I want to talk about the NFL and the national anthem. And also want to talk about the terminology that we in the media are using and legal experts are using to describe what happened in Las Vegas. I just described it as domestic terrorism. I'm perfectly comfortable with that. But as a legal matter, I may be wrong. What are your thoughts on those subjects? 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. So, Sherry, what do you think? I mean, is this thing in Vegas an act of terrorism?
Well, and there's a legal definition, and then there's a larger conceptual definition. The people who study terrorism don't actually say that it has to be ideologically linked, that it's the intent, was the act, whatever it is, meant to instill terror. And this may be a failure of my imagination, but I cannot imagine another reason to do a mass shooting than to instill terror in large groups of people. And so the idea legally, which makes it much more strict and conservative that is linked to ideology are even more stricter, which has begun to appear on the horizon, is that it's only something that people from other countries do. There are people who are trying to write out domestic terrorism as a phrase in the law. It's really not reflective of the larger phenomenon. I agree with you that this is an act of domestic terrorism.
This is the third time in 4 months that we've had a tragedy like this on U.S. soil. In June, we had the guy whose ideological bent tended to be on the left attack Congressman Scalise and the other people on the Republican members of Congress baseball team. In August, we had a white supremacist drive a car into a crowd in Charlottesville who were protesting the appearance of the so-called alt-right and white supremacists. We had during the campaign President Trump talking about radical Islamic terrorism. And in fact, the federal law defines terrorism as the unlawful use of force and violence against persons or property to intimidate or coerce a government, the civilian population, or any segment thereof in furtherance of political or social objective. So there is an ideological thing. So when it comes to legally charging this gunman, who obviously won't be charged because he's dead, but they couldn't have, they can't charge Dylann Roof in Charleston, South Carolina, who killed a room full of African-American churchgoers. They can't charge him as a terrorist.
Well, let's dig into that term ideology, because everybody has ideology. You can't be a living, breathing human being who moves through the world and thinks and feels without having an ideology. It's something everybody has. What they're saying is it has to be somebody that has been identified by maybe the FBI as an ideological group. That's a much more narrow frame, and it's not, as you just pointed out, it does not get at the phenomenon that actually this is a figure that Tom Brokaw is using this morning, that of the 17 mass murders, notice the larger term, since the 1960s, only two have been linked to international terrorism. So the phenomenon is largely people who are homegrown here, who have a, as you just pointed out, wide variety of attitudes. So are we trying to legislate ideology? Are we trying to keep people from being killed?
Yeah. And of course, there's also the distinction between federal law and state law.
Yes.
So state law in Nevada is a little bit looser than the federal legislation. It defines terrorism as an act that involves the use or attempted use of sabotage, coercion, or violence, which is intended to cause great bodily harm and death to the general population. If you spray bullets into a crowd of 20,000 plus people, you are certainly trying to cause great harm in the general population. So perhaps it does qualify as Nevada state terrorism.
But there's a but there, because there's no evidence yet that he was trying to coerce anybody to do something.
We don't know if it was for a particular political, and we may never know. During the Trump administration, the first 9 months of it, so-called radical Islamic terrorists, the term that Mr. Trump likes to use, have had, dozens of people have groups related to ISIS have killed dozens of people in England, in Marseille, France, Edmonton, Canada. But more people have been killed by white men in the United States than anybody related to ISIS so far under Trump.
The profile of the mass killer and the serial killer in the United States is a white man. What's different about this man is that he's older.
So is the shooter in Virginia.
Right.
Yeah,
it's becoming more diverse in terms of age and life position.
It's interesting. And the other thing is, does it matter, or on what level does it matter that we call it domestic terrorism or, a horrific tragedy or a mass shooting? It seems, for example, the Pulse nightclub, it's a little up in the air as to what the motivations of the shooter in that incident really was.
I think it does, because if you don't use domestic terrorism the way you did, the other term is lone wolf, which isolates this person and makes it seem like a personal problem as opposed to a social phenomenon. It doesn't raise it to the level of this is a big issue that is happening with white men in this country. And we tend to do that with things that white people do that are crimes. agonizing what was his motive question is a part of that, that this is an isolated figure. Notice people say there's no sign of mental illness, because that's the first thing that people jump to. And if they can't figure that out, they'll try to figure out what
I'm not sure how they can make that argument. How do you spray bullets and say there's no sign of mental illness? I just don't get that.
Well, it depends on what
you define. You've got to be crazy to do that. I mean,
it depends on what you define
right.
as mental illness.
Right.
And so there's no sign of what many people would consider mental illness. Yes, I agree with you that this is not something a sane person does. Now, the president used, interestingly, the term evil. And that writes it off in a way, because you can't fix evil, or maybe he thinks you can. But I think this idea of trying to isolate this man into something that is not a larger phenomenon is an important question to talk about.
And I wonder if this discussion of gun regulation, gun control, as some people call it, will change at all as a matter of public safety instead of gun rights. Instead of a Second Amendment thing, maybe if we're so concerned about Islamic terrorism that we want to limit travel from, you know, particular countries.
Even countries that don't have terrorism.
Right. Why, you know, as a matter of public safety, wouldn't we want to make it harder for people to obtain the kinds of arsenals that this shooter in Las Vegas obtained?
That would be a very logical statement. And I've been wrong on a number of occasions. I thought after Newtown, when little white children got killed, that would be the tipping point. Maybe today, when it's at a country music festival, as it moves more and more into the mainstream, the victims are more and more into the mainstream, there's a tipping point, but we don't seem to have gotten there yet.
Paula in Chestertown, welcome to Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. I'd like to make two points. Sometimes I think the trying to define these kind of actions as terrorism of one sort or another confuses the issue. I mean, this was an incidence of mass murder, and whether it was politically motivated, whether it was something done out of rage, or some other twisted approach to getting attention, it happened. And as you have been discussing, I think this is about how do you stop this from happening. Just as a matter of note, one of the largest gun shows annually takes place in Nevada, in Reno, or Las Vegas, and that just occurred in January. And I think it's entirely possible this gentleman got all of his guns without going through any gun check, which you can do at a gun show, where they have weapons like this, which are designed to kill.
Right. And of course, we don't know that yet. We don't know that yet. And perhaps we will find that out, you know, in the coming weeks. But Paula, thank you for your call.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, he carried these guns into the hotel. He carried his own bag, so nobody knew. And he didn't do anything that drew attention to it. And the question has been asked but not answered. Could the hotel have done something? Well, in an open carry state, maybe not. The only way to have prevented this would be at the point of entry of the hotel with maybe a check your gun or gun detector. And no one has raised that question. Hospitals and schools have it, but
Some hotels screen luggage as well.
Right, but extending it to all hotels in Nevada, in that state, what I think would be a very controversial point. And, I mean, her point is, how do you stop this? I don't think you stop it without curtailing what many people think is their right to carry guns.
Sure, and when it comes to rights, let's talk about the right to free speech.
Because another
right that's in that...
Spend a lot of time in the Bill of Rights.
That pesky document called the Constitution. But... it's interesting. You hit me to a interesting quote from John F. Kennedy, who said that those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable. That would seem kind of prescient, and I appreciate your turning me on to that. Sandy Unger, former president of Goucher College, former host of All Things Considered, is now heading up a thing called the Free Speech Project at Georgetown University. And they're tracking incidents where free speech has been limited. And, of course, the NFL and Kaepernick and the protests that some of the players are doing during the national anthem is sort of part of this. There's a piece in the Washington Post that said 19% of college students, 19%, that's almost 20%.
It's Brookings Institution.
Yeah, Brookings Institution. They did a poll. 19% of college kids said that physical violence is an acceptable way of shutting down offensive speech. So we think about Berkeley in California, who wanted to have the Republican student organization there wanted to have a thing called Free Speech Week. And they were going to invite Milo Yiannopoulos and Steve Bannon and Ann Coulter and all the, you know, the usual suspects to speak. That ended up not happening. But there were, you know, nationally, kids are saying, yeah, we could be violent at these appearances by these people and that would be okay.
Well, I'm going to say something. I actually understand the frustration of the left because there has been a status quo that was out of balance, that the right could be fierce and angry and say outrageous things with the assumption that the left would be polite and sometimes maybe even docile. So I understand the frustration of students who are saying, no, we have to hit back with force. Certainly the militia, the right-wing militia that have been building up with guns have been covered by the media. And so there's this fear that arises. At the same time, you know, the administrator in me says that universities are supposed to teach people to conduct civil speech. You can say whatever you need to as long as you know a way to say it. And I think the mistake, as a former administrator, that they made is that Ann Coulter is not the voice of reasoned conservatism. There are people that they could invite who would engage the students and have a civil debate. Nicole Wallace, David Frum. There are people. They're mostly in what would be considered liberal media there to provide balance. But there are conservatives who are saying things that are thoughtful and reasonable, and you can disagree with them even if, you know, but they are reasonable. So bringing Ann Coulter is itself a provocative act, and I think the students responded in a provocative way. I think the level of conversation was at the wrong place. That being said, obviously, universities are places that extend adolescence, and we probably don't do as good a job as we should of saying, yes, this can be a safe space, but let's get you ready to go out into the world where it's much more rough and tumble. And so I think students often are stuck in this position of wanting the university to be perfectly safe. And that is a very difficult balance.
There's no place that's perfectly safe, is there?
No, of course not.
I mean, as we just find out, I mean, standing in a field and on the strip in Las Vegas all of a sudden isn't perfectly safe,
right.
Perfectly safe.
And hate crimes on campuses by students has actually has gone up in the last year.
There have been swastikas painted on dorm rooms at Georgetown University, nooses hanging from trees at American universities. It's 30 miles away from where we sit. The Free Speech Project at Georgetown lists all of the times where people have been disallowed from expressing their views. One of the ones they mention is the Baltimore Book Festival. Mm. When BOPA, the Baltimore Office of Promotion and Arts, who puts on the Baltimore Book Festival, rescinded the invitation to Rachel Dalzell, a woman who was the head of the local NAACP chapter in California, who is a white woman who was living as a black woman or identifying as a black woman.
Right.
They got about 100 signatures, something like that, to say she shouldn't be speaking at the Baltimore Book Festival, and they disinvited her. What do you think?
I actually don't know why they disinvited her. I mean, if there's a deeper reason, but it sounds like an attempt just to shut her down, that people should not be able to speak. And that's really what I was trying to get at a minute ago. Without a reasonable arena in which to have a reasonable conversation, people resort to, you must shut up. And I think academics, I mean public media, that part of the public sphere that still exists that's not commercial, and we'll probably get to why I'm saying commercial, have to broaden that conversation so that people have a way to say what they need to say. And it's really tough. Yeah. I mean, it's really, and as someone who tries to do it in her classroom, my proudest moment as a professor, which was someone who was pro-choice and someone who was pro-life, had a reasonable conversation. And while they left disagreeing, they understood the reasons behind what the other felt. It's hard to do in the classroom. It's much harder to do in the public sphere.
Yeah.
But we don't have enough of it.
When we come back, we're going to talk a little football, you know, one of your big areas of expertise.
I know more than you might expect.
That does not surprise me. So more of the Midday Culture Connection with Dr. Sherry Parks when we come back to join the conversation. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. As we go into a break, A little music from Tom Petty. This is You Don't Know How It Feels from his 1994 album Wildflowers. Tom Petty died yesterday in Los Angeles. He was 66 years old.
People come, people go. Some grow young, some grow cold. I woke up in between memory and a dream.
Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. It's the Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. If you'd like to join us on Twitter, you can find us at Midday Tom Hall. So let's talk about the NFL and this wave of protests that began with Colin Kaepernick last season when he was still a member of the San Francisco 49ers. He opted out of that contract, tried to get another contract with another team, and to date has been unsuccessful in that endeavor. There are a lot of people just criticizing the basic premise of bringing politics into the realm of football. Let's talk about that aspect of it first.
Well, let's talk about that, which is, I'm just going to say it's a silly argument. Football, particularly football, but this is true of many sports, has had politics for a very long time. It's in the face of nationalism, the flyovers, the things we take for granted, the flyovers, the bands, the flag, the anthem, all of that is nationalism. And you can see it most prominently at the Super Bowl, where the halftime and the pre-show are very much nationalistic. It's interesting. I just got back from England, where American football is now a huge phenomenon. You know, the Ravens just played there.
Yeah. And so they sort of played there.
they have this perspective. And I was talking to actually a man who has played American football in England, and he said, why wouldn't the football players speak? They have this national and now international platform, and American football has always been political. And so it's interesting that this display of nationalism almost invites somebody who has that platform to use it.
The NBA, well within their legal rights, these are the basketball players, the league has said, you can't do that. You're at work, you work for us, and while you're at work, you cannot exercise that your particular free speech First Amendment right at the workplace. And I assume that this, and I've checked this out with my good buddy Dave Jarros over at the University of Baltimore, employers can dictate to a certain extent what expressions of free speech their employees are, you know, are permitted to do.
And that certainly is where President Trump is coming from when he's arguing that they should be fired, that employees should be fired for it. But what is the workplace of the athlete? Is he or she at work only when they're on the court or the field? Because many people are using their social media to speak. And what counts as free speech? If you're standing there in your uniform and there's no prohibition in your contract that says that you have to stand or you have to kneel.
Because the NFL doesn't have that. You're right.
Right. Then why is he out of bounds? I think at a deeper level, because my job here is more to kind of dig beneath that, it's very interesting because Black men in this country are still seen as the uber masculine, the big, the dark, the muscular. And they're often seen as dangerous unless they're in a uniform, a military uniform, a policeman uniform,
A football uniform.
And so that, because, again, talking to the Englishman, he said those American players, getting hit by them is like getting hit by a train. I mean, they're huge and they're big and perceived as dangerous. The way we talk about them is dangerous. And so it is interesting that when this man does something that's particularly mild, actually even more humble maybe, because that was the point of kneeling versus sitting, is that sitting could be seen as a disrespect. Kneeling is in no way disrespectful. I mean, people do it in churches all the time. And actually, the history of of the Americans standing in front of the flag is that we did not bow to a king, and so you stand. And so he's actually being more humble, and that's what I said a year ago, is that it's actually brilliant.
Now, you were ahead of the curve on that, because the first couple of times Mr. Kaepernick did it, he sat on the bench,
mm-hmm.
and then he started kneeling.
And I said it was brilliant.
And you made you said that was a brilliant pivot.
But I think the black man, and he, stepping out of his place, and I'm using that word on purpose, is so dangerous that people are going ballistic.
And the president has been somewhat successful in turning this into disrespect for the flag and the military and all the things that come with the flag, even the song, the national anthem,
mm-hmm.
instead of Mr. Kaepernick's original intent, which was to protest police misconduct, the kind of unconstitutional police behavior that the Justice Department cataloged in their very damning report a couple of years ago right here in Baltimore.
And notice I use the term nationalism, which is very different than patriotism, and I want to pull those apart because they're being confused. The idea of my country, right or wrong, love it or leave it, is nationalism. The United States is right no matter what it does because it's the United States, as opposed to the patriot who can love his or her country and criticize it at the same time. If we exercise the type of nationalism that many people are calling for, we'd still be English citizens. it doesn't make much sense if you think about it. If you love something, you want to make it better. And that's what he's doing. He's never said, I hate my country. I think he said often, I love my country. And therefore, we want to make it better. And he's found a silent, respectful way. And he doesn't have a job in a league that needs quarterbacks right now,
mm-hmm.
Because people are so upset about this statement.
President Trump does have a job. It's the most powerful job on the planet in the eyes of many people. And he has been successful in convincing people that this is about the flag. I mean, we have people here in Baltimore on a Sunday morning or Sunday afternoon booing when players took a knee 2 days ago to pray. They just assume that, I guess, that when they knelt down, they were protesting the Star-Spangled Banner. So they started booing. And then, of course, a prayer broke out. And then they might have said, well, gee, shucks, I guess I was wrong. You can't inhale and take back the boo.
Well, that's what I think is so interesting about the kneel. And, you know, maybe you get a movement analysis person to come in about what's going on.
Spoken like a true academic, Sherry. You know, we need a movement analysis.
Well, no, there are people who read this, you know, because
that's scary.
Because kneeling is not inherently disrespectful. And the fact that, you know, they misread it because athletic bodies do it as disrespectful, when it's much more associated with the prayer, is, I think, fascinating.
And people also, including the president, demeaned the players because they're rich.
Well,
and when you're rich, you shouldn't do this either.
Well, the unspoken, although sometimes in the sports pages it is spoken, these are black millionaires. You know, the NFL particularly is, you know, 70% black men. So, and there's a social class aspect to it, because there was an article in Forbes a couple of years ago. This was about basketball player, about Shaq, and it said, he's a millionaire and he handles his money well. That there's this stereotype of these people who don't do very much and they play a game. I've seen that written. They play a game. They push a ball around, and they're millionaires, and they should be grateful. There are echoes of black. Remember with Michelle Obama, she should be grateful that just because we let you stay here, you should be grateful. And I think many people, and this is really one I wanted to dig into, do not understand the day-to-day lives of football players, that the game is brutal. Their lives, their well-being, their brains are on the line. The hierarchy of the game is such that it's very black at the bottom and very white at the top, and those owners have a lot of control, that their political position is not as highly privileged as one would assume.
Let's go to the phones. Alan in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Dr. Sherry Parks.
Thanks for taking the call. Just two quick points. One regarding respect versus disrespect with kneeling. Players routinely take a knee when one of their players is injured and carted off the field. soldiers, when presenting the folded flag to the family or spouse of a dead soldier, take a knee as they present the flag. It's clearly a sign of respect. And with regard to the freedom of speech in the workplace, 28 of 32 NFL owners have come out in favor of the players' right to respect. So the employer says it's okay to kneel and do this protest at their game.
Good point, Alan. Appreciate the call. And Sherry, what do you make of the fact that after President Trump made his remarks and tweeted his head off instead of paying attention to Puerto Rico and some other things, you know, a couple of weeks ago, almost 200 players took a knee. Just this past Sunday, a couple of days ago, a week or so after the president had tweeted all that stuff, only 52. And they came from like a handful of teams. So there are a whole bunch of teams in which nobody knelt, including the Baltimore Ravens, for what it's worth. So all of a sudden now, and nobody in the first few weeks that Colin Kaepernick was doing it was kneeling with them. Mm-hmm. And then very gradually a few, 2, 3, 4 people did it. And it took a long time for that protest to migrate from the San Francisco 49ers to other teams. So what do you make of that?
Well, I think many people underestimate how brave it was for him to kneel. I mean, that's the hierarchy at work that I was just telling about, that players are living very controlled lives. And that's what I meant when I said I may know more, because I know more about the day-to-day lives of players, because I know people who've gone into the NFL and I know what their lives are like. So it was very brave. And I think people are like, I don't know, you know, the guy doesn't have a job and I need a job. And then what happened was that you really had this outburst of response when the president started calling athletes names. I mean, he was saying, and you had people.
SOBs.
Right. Which is very disrespectful. What other job would you just come out and say that and feel that that's safe to do that, no matter how you felt about them? And that's when you begin to get LeBron James and other people, you know, calling the president a bum. I mean, the idea that the presidency is an elevated position is gone.
Let's talk about the Star-Spangled Banner itself.
Okay.
Because these protests are happening during the
and
song.
And you're a music guy.
I am a music guy. And one of the conversations is around the third verse of the anthem. There are four verses that Francis Scott Key, right here in Baltimore, wrote as the defense of Fort McHenry, which became the national anthem in the 1930s, I guess. No refuge could save the hiring and slave from the terror of flight or the gloom of the grave. That's the contentious line. So when you read those words, no refuge could save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight or the gloom of the grave. We're talking about the War of 1812, written in 1814. How do you read those lines?
Well, let me back up a minute. There was a study that said that most Americans did not know the words of the Star-Spangled Banner.
Yeah, that goes without saying.
Right. And so many Americans didn't know that, if you're that invested in a song, wouldn't you know the words? If this true investment. And then many Americans did not know about the third verse. Many African Americans did. And so many of us went through phases where we, like, do we stand? Do we sit? You know, what does it mean?
Well, first of all, no one ever sings the third verse. They don't get past the first verse.
Right.
But do you read those lines of poetry as bigoted, as racist?
Oh, sure. Sure. I mean, how do you not? I mean, the idea that...
Here's how you not, because, you know, the guy who understands this piece in a particular way is the expert on Francis Scott Key. He happens to be a friend of mine. His name is David Hildebrand. He runs a thing called the Colonial Music Institute. He says that that's simply reporting. He says that we're the hirelings and slaves, both of whom had all sorts of reasons to support the people who were against the Americans, you know, mm-hmm. So mercenaries from Germany, Native Americans who joined with the British, and slaves who had no reason to be supportive of an American system that enslaved them.
And the British offered them freedom.
Yeah. Right. They said no refuge could save them. In other words, we won the war. That's where he sees that as a bit of reportage.
Okay, and that would be fine if this were a song that was simply reporting it. And this gets back to something I've been talking about a lot, about the difference between displaying something and honoring it with monuments. Here, this is the national monument. By the way, I think America and the Beautiful is a much better
national. Yeah, that's
national,
a whole other conversation.
Right. But here you've got the national anthem. And therefore is problematic.
All right. Sherry Parks, Associate Professor in the Department of American Studies at the University of Maryland. College Park. She's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. She joins us every month for Culture Connections here on Midday. Thanks to Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. Coming up on the program tomorrow, we're going to talk bioethics with Jeff Kahn from Johns Hopkins. And looking ahead to next week on Tuesday, you're welcome to join us for a special broadcast Midday live from the Baltimore Museum of Industry. Come to the website wypr.org/midday and reserve a free place at the Baltimore Museum of Industry to see us do our show. I'm Tom Hall. On behalf of the entire Midday team, we appreciate you listening. Have a great day.